We could acknowledge the you getting busted out by your parents for profanity and then tell the story about the Relais Chateau dinner where you kept swearing in the dining room.
Ugh, yeah, that'll work. I was nervous, man.
Hello, please. All right, everyone, welcome to another edition of Hot Dogs and Caviar, the podcast where two formerly unemployed, now unfortunately employed chefs with no time on their hands, come together and talk about culinary topics of the day. As usual, we've got our the Richard Simmons to my David Letterman, Tarver Super King King, who is, as I said, a semi-permanent guest. And Tarver is the subject of the funny story this week, and this one's awesome. Okay, so we try to be a family podcast, but sometimes we fall short. Sometimes I'll click the explicit tag, and sometimes
when have we
I
not
don't.
Fallen short?
What do
you mean try?
Every time you've been on, we've fallen short. Tarver, all of us do. We have especially coarse language. Like you wouldn't believe how much profanity I edit out of every single one of these episodes just to keep it to a minimum. Like unbelievable.
That's the way you talk.
It's the way we all talk. We are on our best behavior all the time. And I'm keeping a bunch of B-reel. So one day I'm going to put together a 45-minute compilation of saying things that we just couldn't say on the regular podcast, sometimes because they're profane and sometimes because they're genuinely vile. And I guess maybe we'll have some sort of process where you apply and we vet you and find out if you're old enough for this horrible content. But, you know, the internet is a cesspool. But at any rate... So, I've been having to click the explicit tag a lot lately, which is fine. I don't care. We're cooks. The stuff that comes out of our mouths is genuinely awful. But we're also
usually is in
just super nice guys. It's just the way it is. It's the vernacular of our trade. But that
get excited.
But yeah, we get excited and we lose track of what's going on. That doesn't make it okay with necessarily our moms and dads.
Sorry, mom and dad.
Got busted by his parents for using foul language on the podcast and. I think that's fantastic. So, hi.
I'm getting ready to go down to Virginia Beach in a couple days, and my dad's going to give me an earful, I know.
Hi, Tarver's dad. Hi, Tarver's mom. We'll be good.
We'll try.
So, the funny story for this week is another time this happened. The thing is, Tarver has this ebullient enthusiasm that is just out of control. He's the happiest, most excited guy that I've ever met in my entire life. And sometimes... He just, you know, the excitement bubbles over a little bit. So there was one time where we had done a really, really nice Relais Gourmand dinner. And Darma went out to thank the crowd and credit his guest chef. Who was the guest chef again? It was an old friend of yours, right?
Yeah, his name is Justin LeBeau. He's a absolute monster in the kitchen. I mean that in the most talented sense of the word. Like that dude is really good. He's got a few restaurants up in Canada. He's been like rated like best chef in Canada.
Awesome.
Yeah. Now I have the worst memory. What are his restaurants names? Pigeonhole and Model Milk. Great dude. We worked together at the Inn of Little Washington like years and years ago. I worked meat. We worked fish. So we were like, you know, joined at the hip for a lot of it. He's a good dude.
But that's awesome.
Yeah,
he's awesome.
Yeah. Well, so anyway,
good dude. Yeah, that was a good dinner, by the way.
That was awesome.
No, of course, that's the whole thing. No one's saying it wasn't a great dinner. Everyone's saying it was such a success. Tarver gets all amped.
Well, it was all of Relais Chateau, like the entire board. Patrick O'Connell. I mean, all of them. Like our dining room was full of like celebrity chefs and like, I mean, I don't know how I've been out of Relais Chateau because I haven't been in a, you know, hotel in a while, but like we were a Relais Gourmand restaurant. I don't know if that still holds the same amount of weight as it used to, but like we were shaking in our boots, man. Like it was a big deal all of them.
It came off a success and the sense of excitement and relief was, by the way, the fact that the place was a murderer's row of awesome, famous chefs. Makes this story 40% funnier, if we can think about it.
Yeah, Greg Kuntz was there.
Oh, my God. Oh, Les Menace. He's like one of the OG New York badasses. Oh, man.
I know.
So, anyway, I wasn't there for this, by the way. I started a little bit after this, but the story was legendary by the time I got there. So, Tarver,
this story that you're prefacing, I still have these cringe moments. I'll be driving in my car... And I'll remember it, and I'll be like, Oh, God, yeah, that did happen, didn't it?
So he goes out there, and he just thanks the crowd. He's so excited that it went off a treat. Thanks the crowd, thanks Erling Gormand, thanks his guest chef. But man,
well, the whole kitchen was standing out there, too. They invited the whole kitchen staff. Team.
It was everyone.
Nate, you take over. You were there. Just keep it clean.
Oh, we were just all standing there, and Hugues Le Bert, one of the most polished front of the house badass maitre d's you'd ever meet in your life, is just giving this wonderful speech and thanking everyone. And he's like the most polished, you know, C-3PO restaurant robot you'd ever meet in your life. He's a badass. And he hands the mic to Tarver, and he's just so amped. He's like, I just want to thank everybody for effing coming here. I got my good friend Justin. He's effing awesome. And we're all just bursting with laugh, trying not to laugh. And he just keeps doing it, and everyone's head just whips around, and his tall eyes are on Tarver, and he's just cussing like a sail. It was awesome.
Cringing right now.
First off, it was years ago.
This
second
is my
off,
friend Justin. He's an effing good friend of mine. He's an effing badass.
No one. The thing is, Tarver, no one could.
You
no
were
one,
like in the middle of the squared circle at a wrestling match. Let me tell you something, everybody.
The thing is,
it was so great.
I was just thinking of something. Do you remember when? This was so long ago. We were doing charcuterie back before charcuterie was cool. We like converted the office into like a aging room. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, and we had like approval by SCPMD, the South Carolina Meat and Poultry, and like FDA and all this kind of stuff. But the health department was like, you know, freaking out and all this kind of stuff. But I remember I was like, Paul Bertoli is a god. Uh-huh. I don't know if anyone listening to this doesn't know who Paul Bertoli is. Google it, go get Cooking by Hand on Amazon. I mean, I got that book for $1 because it was used from a library. He is brilliant, but he was doing a lot of it, and he started Fermani. Anyway, do you remember this, Nate? Like,
yes, I do.
I was like,
yeah. Dude,
I'm gonna call
I will never forget this.
This was hilarious. Like, I was watching this happen. I was standing there.
I called his restaurant and just asked if I could speak to Paul Bertoli, and he answered.
That's awesome.
I was like, my palms were sweating, and I was just like telling him about the situation and how we're having trouble with like the health department. And like, you know, we were following, you know, everything was done correctly. This is a process of curing meat that's been done for thousands of years, but just because it's between the temperatures of 40 and 140, it was like, you know, sacrilegious, you know,
they didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah. I had no idea about, salt levels.
We knew we were the experts in scared DHEC.
Yeah, I know. So I'm like talking to Paul Bertoli, and he's like, we're like having a conversation, and we're like getting along. And in the back of my mind, I'm like, stay cool, stay cool, stay cool. And like, I couldn't do it anymore. Like after like the conversation went on, I was like, I just need you to know that I think you're like the greatest chef in the entire world. I just think you're amazing and all this kind of stuff. He was like, well, all right. Talk to you later. Bye. And he like hung up. I was like, damn it, Tarver. What are you doing?
So close. And yet so far.
So close, man.
The thing is, I'm just going to speak up here.
I was basically like hanging off of your back, like listening to that. I was like, oh my God, my God.
I was watching from across the room, and you, for all the world, looked like two 14-year-old high school freshman girls who called the starting quarterback's house, and he picked up. That's what you guys look like.
Carver, you were Nate like, was, they're going to get him! They're going to get him!
Nate was just like, you idiot, man! You're an idiot!
Oh, no, I mean, the thing is, they had a similar reaction the time I called Armando Money.
Yeah, we talked to him.
Yeah, he's a cool guy! Yeah, we were talking about picking up his oil. You called the number, And the phone rang, and I'm just like, I'm going to talk to their rep. I'm going to see if I can get us a sample. And the phone picks up, and it's like, hello, this is Armando. And I was like, oh, hi. I recovered pretty quickly, but it was awesome. You don't expect always to get the guy.
Did you get some? That olive oil is so good.
We got a sample. We were starting to put together. Woodlands was doing the gift shop, so we were going to do a split. And the minimum order was really big, so we couldn't make it work. And then,
did you get for me or for my son?
I don't remember.
I think he sent us a sample of both of them.
Yeah, he sent us a couple of things. The thing is, it was right.
A big ask. It was a big. He needed a lot. He needed us to buy a lot.
Yeah, the minimum order. You had to get a case, and the case was like, I can't remember how many bottles, but it was a lot, and the individual bottle price was really high. And the GM of the Woodlands was actually being surprisingly cool about it. But at the end of the day, this is when all the air was coming out of the Woodlands balloon. And
do you remember? I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're good. No, I'm
just saying. Iberico de Belota was like first being allowed in the United States, and how we like it was basically like we were like calling and calling and calling over and over and over and over and over until we got like accepted to get one hand.
Yeah, you were on the wait list for like 2 years. Yeah,
and we got one. I didn't ask for permission or anything. Marty Wall ripped me a new one for that. I mean, like we spent, what was it, like almost $3,000 on a ham? It was something. Maybe it wasn't that much.
I think it was a lot. I remember a thousand. I remember it being $1,000 ham.
Yeah, it was like $900 or
and
something.
And not
like
a
that.
Particularly big ham.
No.
It was,
no, yeah, those pigs are kind of small.
It wasn't done the same, if I remember right, it wasn't done the same way as the stuff in Europe.
Like, yeah, they had to take the foot off.
Yeah, they had to take the foot off. They didn't do it in a cave. They had to do it in like a facility. They like replicated the temperatures and everything, but it wasn't like in a cave or whatever, like it's usually done. But man, that stuff's good.
Yeah. You know, and now it's actually a lot easier to get a hold of. Like we got a wine bar in town called Stems and Skins. And they sell it for like $10 an ounce.
Yeah. I smuggled some back from when I staged at the Fat Duck.
Awesome.
You remember that, Nate? That stuff was
good. I remember.
God, it's so good. It's so good. Just cryovacked it and put it inside of a book. Like I felt like I could have smuggled drugs. No one looked.
Yeah.
if you get popped by a random sweep and they're looking for ham, they'll just throw your ham away. Whereas if you get popped by a random sweep with a bag of coke, you, my friend, are going to jail. So that's the difference. It's like, so I guess what I'm saying is, I don't feel like we should start up a drug smuggling ring just yet. I'm not nearly smart enough for something like that. But one of the things that was great about the Woodlands was just the specialty purveyors, like the guy that just sold us Wagyu or
the snail guy,
Doug.
Yeah, those snails were awesome.
So good. That guy
came from like gypsies in France, and they just went around random fields and waited for it to grow, and then the grass or the whatever they were eating the best to snails. Grow and pluck them off and cook and them then, right there.
You know, you had Honolulu Fish was great. There were so many great vendors that only sold us like one or two things. And the thing is, when you're at the top level, that's what you do. You have specialty vendors. You're like, I get this from this guy. I get this from this guy.
I don't have my hookup for that A5 Kobe anymore. That stuff was unbelievably good.
I got some from somewhere for Siwi last year, and I don't even remember where it was from.
Dude, just to go back to the ham real fast. Sorry, I'll share. Yeah. When I was staging at the Fat Duck, they used that Iberico for the snail porridge dish, which was phenomenally good, but they only used, and Nate, you can correct me on the name, is it the heart of the ham, the culatello? They only used the heart for that dish. So there was so much Iberico trim that like went to like, I mean, not necessarily staff meal, but like you could eat. I remember like when I was prepping that dish, like I was like, I can eat this. I was full, like so much of that stuff. It was so good.
They had more trim than they could use, right?
Yeah, man. That snail porridge is
that's
brilliant.
Next level badass right there.
Yeah.
You know, the thing is, you can talk about Iberico, but I mean, America has got some great country hams right now.
Oh,
you're in Virginia. You've had Suriano, right?
Oh yeah, we talked about Edwards with the thumb sausages. Yeah, Edwards. Yeah, the Suriano and
Is that them?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's them.
Phenomenal. That Suriano ham is one of the best I've had. The best one I had, I don't remember for the life of me where it's from, but there was a Mangalitsa country ham, using those the Philippine sort of woolly pigs, the Mangalitsas. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And first off, it was incredible country ham. It was dark in color. You could shave it like prosciutto. It was really dried and like aged, but it had a fat cap on it that was like an inch and a half thick. Now, at first I was annoyed because I was like, man, that is an expensive ham. And I had all this fat cap. But then I was like, wait a minute. I know what I'll do. Cut all the fat cap off. You know, gave the whole thing a nice Hollywood to where it was just maybe a third of an inch of fat around the ham. And then took all that fat and trimmed it and used it as lardo. And so country ham lardo.
Leading up to some really funny story. Go ahead.
Fair enough. But and then like my sous chef, Greg, he was always wanting to put a pizza on the menu. And I was like, the rule is the pizza has to look like something I would have come up with. That's you learn when you're a sous, you learn to match the style of the person you're working for. And he would do all these super great pizzas, but they were always really stoner, like, you know, sambal and honey under the tomato sauce, and then sausage and bacon and pepperoni. And I was like, nah, man, we do nuance here. And he never really got it. And then he took 2 days and he came in and I was like, how's it going, man? How are the last 2 days? He goes, I have a pizza for you to try. And I was like, okay, that was cool. He took a pizza crust and brushed it with olive oil. Then he put thinly sliced raw zucchini and crookneck squash all over the whole thing. Gave that a pinch of salt, and then baked it just like that. So the squash baked right into the pizza crust. Oh, and a little tiny sprinkling of mozz, like about a third as much mozzarella as you'd have on an old pizza. And then when it came out of the oven, he dressed some arugula with a squeeze of lemon and a pinch of flordicel, spread that all over everything, and then put a bunch of strips of our Mangalitsa ham lardo over it, and then popped it under the heat lamp for about 10 seconds. I was so proud.
That sounds good.
He made delicate, beautiful, nuanced, interesting pizza that I was all about selling. I was like, okay, this just needs a name now. I don't even remember what we called it, but I was so proud. Like,
that sounds great.
He reeled his style back. That's the day he figured out how to really be a sous chef and not just a salaried line cook. Is I think when you take on something like that, you actually are able to express the style of your boss. That's what made me so proud. I was
sorry, man. I feel like I was interrupting you. Sorry. We had a farmer around here that was raising Mangalitsas, and we got a whole Mangalitsa in. That what you experienced on that ham is the entire animal. They are super tasty, and like the meat itself is like super marbled and everything, but like there was like a 3 or 4 inch cap of fat over the entire animal. Like we got a lot of really good meat out of it, but we rendered probably close to 5 gallons worth of just lard, and then the rest of it we turned into close to 20 pounds of lardo. But the story that I was going to bring up, Nate will remember this. it was when we were getting into charcuterie and stuff, and we were making lardo, and like, you know, the old school traditional way was like, you know, you would put it in a marble box so that there would be no light that got into it. And we were like, how do we get a marble box and all this kind of stuff? And I think it was Nate's idea. He was like, what about like a casket for like a pet, you know, like they make like really beautiful. So I called this like, it was like an animal shelter or something like that. And I was like, I was like, my Fluffy died. I need a casket for my cat. And they're like, yeah, they're like, we have caskets. And I was like, what are they made out of? And they're like, they're mostly just like plastic or wood. I was like, no, it has to be marble. It has to be marble. And they're like, we don't know what the fuck you're talking about.
You know, I think if you just would have gone to like a Monument Masons, like a gravestone company, and just asked them to make you a box, they probably would have.
Dude, this was so long ago. We didn't think of that. Yeah, you're probably right. There was no such thing as an iPhone then. You know, like if you were to Google something, you had to go down into the
computer. And we looked it up in the Yellow Pages.
Yeah.
That is old school. Oh, man, that is hilarious.
My God, I can't believe that happened.
Like, to the listeners at home, we don't really have an agenda today. We're just going to talk about some small topics that we've been kicking around. I wanted to let you guys know, I have a new favorite dish to cook, like a favorite traditional dish that is my favorite thing ever at the moment. It's amazing, and I want to tell you guys about it. It is a Romanian dish called sarmale, Sarmale.
Oh yeah.
And you've had it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's astoundingly good. Like, it's whole leaf sauerkraut, and you make pork rolls in the whole leaf sauerkraut, and the pork rolls are, I mean, it's pretty traditional pork meatball mix, but they put raw arborio rice in there, and they kind of toast it and saute it with the aromats. So you sweat the aromats, and you toast some arborio in there. And I've had a lot of, like, Eastern European and Middle Eastern meatballs that have raw rice in them, and it's a pretty cool trick because they cook... in the meatball in the sort of ambient juice that gets rendered out of the meatball as it cooks. So it's not like having rice that just tastes like cooked rice in there. It's rice that tastes like whatever the meatball's made of, which is a really smart way to stretch. And, you know, in a pound of meat, it was like 3 tablespoons of raw rice. But when you think about it, that means more like 9 tablespoons of volume at the end of the cooked rice. So it makes the meatballs moister and plumper. And, I mean, you know, like a lot of people think of any kind of panade in a meatball as a cheat. But you have to do it. If you just, otherwise, you're just going to have a piece of, you know, an overcooked hamburger texture. You get that panade in there, and you get such a moister, more tender meatball. So the raw rice thing was just a great trick. And then you make little pork rolls in the raw rice. You make little pork rolls in the whole leaf sauerkraut. Then you take a casserole, layer it with onions, and then a bunch of picked thyme leaves and some shredded sauerkraut, like scrap for making the rolls is usually enough. Lay the rolls in there with like bay leaves between every third roll. You do a couple of stacks like that into a casserole, then top the whole thing off with some beef stock. I used a really fatty beef stock that I made using. I had some short ribs from the Asian store, some of those thin cut ones, and they were kind of freezer burned. So I just made a stock with those. It probably wasn't the most economical thing, but left all the grease in there, like full fat beef stock, mixed with some tomato passato. And then just bake all that for like 2 hours, 90 minutes covered, and then the last 30 minutes uncovered. It's one of the best things I've ever put in my face.
Dude, that whole leaf sauerkraut alone, if that's such, I mean, when I first heard about that, I was like, that it's just like kimchi, but, you know, sauerkraut, you know, I don't know why it wasn't done whole, you know, there should be whole leaf stuff at the store, man. You can stuff anything.
Jesse inspired me to make my own. Jesse inspired me to make my own whole leaf sauerkraut.
Cool.
And I got some going. I've had it going for a couple months now when he first told me about this dish that he was trying to make. And I knew it would be good. I'd never had one, but damn, that stuff is so good. I cooked some corned beef and just did like little Reuben roll-ups.
Awesome.
And this whole leaf sauerkraut. It was phenomenal.
I actually found
more of that. I'll put the recipe up on the blog.
Oh, yeah.
For my kraut, but I mean, it's real simple. It's just,
and when I do this cookbook review, I'm going to do this review pretty soon, the Romanian one. But also I'm going to rework the sarmale. There were a few, this book is just a little spoiler. It's about 75% good. The recipes aren't very precise and there's little steps that don't work, which is true in so many cookbooks. Like this is one of those cookbooks that if you know what you're doing, if you're a pro or a very good home cook, you could probably do a lot of really interesting things. But if you don't know much, like, you know what I mean? How sometimes you have to look at a recipe and be like, okay, no, that's wrong. So I'm going to work around it. There's a little of that going on. So I kind of want to take another crack at this thing. So either this Monday or Tuesday, I'm going to make another one. Once I come up with a full-on original recipe that doesn't crib from the book, I'll put one up on the blog because everyone needs to know how to make this. It's like the ultimate party dish. Like, there's no reason you couldn't have some for, like, the Super Bowl or, you know, just a Thanksgiving dinner. I mean, it's just such an incredibly good dish to feed a crowd. I'm so excited about it. So look forward for that. Look forward for that on the blog. And I found whole leaf sauerkraut at the Russian grocery that's over in West Ashley.
That's cool. Dude, so, speaking of party dishes, sometimes for staff meal, we would do a spaghetti stuffed meatball. And be like, it's like the size of my head. And I have a large head.
Wow, yeah, that's terrifying.
It was awesome, man. I don't know why I thought about that after something as cool as that.
No. I'm intrigued now. First off, spaghetti stuffed meatball, is this like that scallop wrapped bacon where we took the scallop mousse and put it around the pork belly?
Oh yeah, that was good.
It's like take the thing that's normally on the outside and put it on the inside.
Dude, that scallop mousse, the scallop dumpling that we created at Woodlands years ago is still an ace up my sleeve now. It's like one of the most easiest things. I remember when Sean Brock came to eat that one time, he was like, how do you do that with like methlacel or whatever? I was like,
you wouldn't even believe how easy it is. It was, man.
Like, scallop and cream, dude. A little bit of salt. He was like, "That's so, he was that was awesome."
I've been using that one for years, dude. I love.
Yeah, man. Shit. scallop gnocchi, doing that stuff. So awesome.
Scrambled scallops.
Scrambled scallops. I was just going to say that. That is so good.
It is killer good.
Scallops is so awesome.
Yeah. I did something with the scallop dumpling mix that was not even remotely cost effective, but it looked and tasted really great. And that was, I took a fish fillet and smeared one side of it and then put thin slices of scallops like scales over the whole thing. And then seared them. And so the searing kind of set the mousse. So you had a fish fillet that was crusted in seared scallop. They didn't sear perfectly. It was really hard to get like a nice even color on them.
Yeah.
You still had a thin layer of that toasted scallop flavor over a piece of grouper. It looked and tasted great. It just wasn't even remotely practical because it was like 2.5 entrees worth of scallops on a single fish fillet. So I was like, there's no way I will ever be able to make money with this idea. But damn, did it look and taste great.
Last night. I said, I didn't realize I said that out loud. I was like, I had a dream about scallops last night.
That's wow.
Crazy that we're talking about scallops.
No, that's
I love scallops, man. You don't see, like, I mean, that people ruin them all over
the time.
I feel bad for the ocean for what people do to them, man. They're so good. Like, scallops are just one of those, you know, nature's perfect foods,
yeah.
You know.
They cost as much as a ribeye does now, too.
Dude, it's crazy, yeah.
And the thing is,
they're so good, though.
They're so popular in Charleston. Like, it's funny because they don't come from anywhere. People are like, oh, we're in Charleston. We got to have seafood. And then they'll get the scallops. I was like, yeah, I really appreciate where your head's at. And the thing is, all the restaurants have them here. Tarver, when you were here, did you ever use Northern Fish for scallops?
No, don't.
It's Mark from Northern Fish. He's got a thick Boston accent, so there's no R's in his name at all. It's Mark from Northern Fish. He brings these scallops that are the least processed scallops I've seen. The only ones I've ever used that were better were the live scallops from Brown Trading. This guy's scallops are so banging. They're stupidly expensive, like all great scallops, but they sear up perfectly. There's no chem wash on them at all. They are perfectly dry. The sizing is all over the place, so you got to deal with that. But once you're okay with all over the place sizing, they are absolutely perfect. The only ones I've seen that were better were the ones from Brown Trading. The sizing of
Who did we use when we were at Woodlands, Nate? Do you remember? Is that Profish? Was that their name? Whatever seafood company it was. Do you remember the time that they called us up and they're like, "Hey, one of our fisherman buddies caught like a 400-pound bluefin. You should come see this thing."
Oh yeah.
You remember when we went down there and we saw
that? That was Low Country.
We popped the marrow out of the spine and they thought we were freaking crazy. That marrow was so good.
They're like, "Do you want anything off of this?" And we were like, "Yeah, we'll take both bellies." And they gave us like the sickest Toro for like loin price. Like, whatever it was, like, you know, $16 a pound or 12 or whatever. But like Toro, for listeners to know, like if you get like full grown bluefin belly, it's like $40 a pound. It was like a huge deal. Yeah. And it was like still twitching. It was so fresh. That stuff is so good.
Yeah, we kept the spine too.
Yeah,
and we got all the marrow out of it, and then we dried it out, and we had those cool little serving pieces from like the backbone of the tuna.
Oh, the vertebrae. Yeah, we dried out the vertebrae.
That
was
cool, man.
And the thing that amazed me the most about that was just watching. It took four guys to break down this tuna because they say 400 pounds. This thing's like 6.5 feet long. And like,
it's a Toyota Corolla.
Yeah, it's a full-on car. As thick as a tree trunk. This gigantic fish. So they had one guy on the back of it, like holding it in like a Boston crab. Tarver, that's a wrestling reference.
Went right over my head.
It was a reverse Boston crab because he was pulling up on the neck. So it was a full Nelson camel clutch. You had one guy on the thing in a camel clutch. And then on the other side, you had a guy with a sword, not a knife. It was a sword. Who just running down the length of the thing. And then you had two other guys that were gently lifting the full. So one guy held it in a camel clutch to hold it straight. And one guy wielded the sword. And the other two guys took the fillet off this thing. And the thing must have weighed 100 pounds, the main loin. And as the guy cut down, the other two just kind of gently rocked it back to stop it from falling back into the workspace and to keep it intact. It took four dudes to fillet a fish. And they were all working hard. It was amazing.
Can you imagine catching that thing in the ocean?
Oh, God.
He probably fought that thing for an hour.
Way. Yeah, they got to use mechanical winches or something, man.
Oh, they have to. There's no way. Like, that fish is stronger than you.
All day.
All day.
I mean, I caught like a 2.5-foot bonnethead shark, and it was a hassle to get it in. And then when I finally got it up above the water, the thing weighed like 6 pounds. Is like a 6-pound fish definitely wore me out, and this is a 400-pound game fish.
I mean, it must have been 2 or 3 guys with gaff hooks trying to get it over the edge of the boat, like getting it into the boat.
And you gotta get them in quick too, because if they keep fighting on the line and they leave them on the line too long, that lactic acid builds up in their muscles, and then that's when you get those little pus packs. You ever seen the pussy?
Oh yeah.
That's from dying or fighting too long on the line, man.
That's the only bad thing about
it. You gotta catch
them
right too, man.
Yeah.
It's crazy, dude.
Yeah, that's like the only downside to it. I mean, they're able to pull in like tons of fish fishing that like that, but yeah, they end up, you know, dying on the line a lot. But
yeah,
that's
just like, what was that? Perfect Storm? When that's the way.
Oh, yeah. That was good.
Yeah.
Like, we're the only guys that could watch The Perfect Storm and come away with, like, I just learned a lot about the fishing industry.
I mean,
I wonder what happened to all that tuna.
Yeah. Like, it just really says something about our focus that we're like, ones that.
Mark Wahlberg, I know you're having a hard time, but you might want to remember the fish. Yeah, you got there, buddy.
It's like, I feel like we're watching the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and everyone else is like, oh my God, he's cutting up teenagers. And we're like, what kind of seasoning would you put in a human kidney pie?
This is the, sorry, hold on a second. This is the second time that you go to murder and eating people, Jesse. On the last episode, we were talking about Fergus Henderson, how he would be you said he would be a great serial killer. And now you're talking about how to eat people.
Yeah.
Is there something you might need to talk to somebody, man.
I've been hanging out with Verena. I would eat Adam.
Verena.
I miss that girl so much. Oh, she was great.
She commented on the last podcast.
Did she? Oh, hi, Verena.
Oh, awesome. Yep. Hi, Verena. Do you remember when we made that? It was like for those little tiny little bites of soup. We'd made like a cherry and foie gras soup. Just like rendering in foie gras fat. And we like looked over in the side at the end of service and she was drinking it out of a Bain Marie. Like, geez, Verena.
Slamming it.
She had a spoon.
Yeah, though, she was so funny. She would like, I would always have scrap avocados from the avocado and oyster carpaccio, and she would do anything for them. She's like, Jesse, do you have any scrap avocado? I'm here to do my vulture business because we used to call her the vulture. So she'd do like a little, like she'd run around with her arms out like she was flying and then steal all the scraps. That girl was hilarious.
I was so proud of her one time. Like, I don't know, one of the things that we took from that we got out of the Fat Duck Stodge thing was like adding mayonnaise to gazpacho. Enriching it. And I remember we were doing some kind of gazpacho, and I had already told Verena that, and she was like, oh, that's why it's so good, and all this kind of stuff. Like, and we were out, like, doing the pre-shift with the entire wait staff, and I was describing the gazpacho, and I was like, and we have one little trick that we do to, like, enrichen it, and before I could say anything, Verena goes, you add mayonnaise, and, like, Oog and Stefan and the entire staff are like, shut up, Verena. They don't put mayonnaise in the gazpacho. And I was like, actually, she's absolutely right. That's exactly what I was just about to say. And she was like, I told you. She's so proud.
Yeah. Oh, man. I remember it was her last day, and she was going back to Austria. And I asked her, like, you know, what do you want for staff meal? I was like, what's your favorite? And she goes, I want Fleischknödel. I was like, okay, Fleischknödel. So I went home and got out one of my culinarias, the one that has Austria in it. I love those culinary books.
Good, like, books.
The recipes books are not
great
good.
Great reference.
The recipes are not good, but if you just want a good picture of the cuisine of an area.
Beautiful books.
And then you can usually get them for like pennies on the dollar. Like I paid more than $10 for one of them. They're all like $50 books, but you can get them online for cheap. Partly because the recipes don't work. I mean, that is like a legit concern. They're too, like, if you know what you're doing, you can look at the recipe and be like, okay, how would I actually make something using the ingredients in this list? But the recipes aren't checked, and they can't be. But
they're also like really old recipes too, man.
Right.
beautiful.
The kind of recipes that like a hotel chef or a European grandmother could be like, okay, I know what to do. Whereas an American that didn't grow up around that kind of food would try to follow it and be like, this does not look like the picture. But a Fleischnoodle is meat dumplings. So it's the Fleisch like flesh and Noodle like noodle. And so I just learned how to do it. I took, it was like, the recipe was super country style. You made a potato dough, like a, almost like a, like a pierogi dough with a, mm-hmm. a mashed potato based pierogi dough. It was a little softer. It wasn't nearly as, like, you know how pierogies actually kind of hold their shape? These were very soft and yielding. I cooked them wrapped in plastic, but like the scallop dumpling. And then for the filling, it just said, you know, ground salted pork meats.
I'm getting hungry. No, go ahead.
So my solution for that was I just went through and got all of the charcuterie ends in the kitchen. Like, you know, the end pieces of sausages and the end pieces of hams and even some like end pieces of deli meats left over from like lunch trays. And like a scrap piece of pork belly from squaring off the pork belly and just crushed all that through the meat grinder. And man, it was a really good little dish. And so I will always appreciate Verena for turning me on to Fleischnoodle. Like I always love to learn a new dish. And from like, that was just, it was such a happy accident. I was wondering if she was just going to be like, oh, I want hamburgers or something like that because she was always eating everything. But if I was a small girl, like just
there's
a little,
nothing that tiny little girl wouldn't eat, man.
A little, just a little person with a big appetite. But then she threw me that curveball. She was like, I want Fleischnoodle. And I was like, well, I said I'd do it without qualifying, and now I have to learn. So I did my homework, and it was awesome. But that's
what's so good about, like, exploring, like, other countries, like, you know, real food. At Patamac, we used to do this thing called Sunday Supper, and we ended up, like, doing a different country every time. The first country that our dishwasher, this awesome guy named Justo, was Peruvian. So the first one we did was Peru. And every time we did one of these things, you know, whether it was Peru or, you know, Peloponnese region of Greece, or, you know, we would do like the north or the south of Italy. Every time we did one of those, you come away with like new techniques. You come away with like a better understanding. It really changes you. Like you should, yeah, I love doing that kind of thing. When we did Peru, a tear came to his eye and stuff, you know, because he missed home a lot. And we had like pisco sours and stuff. You guys ever eat Peruvian food? Is there like good Peruvian food down there?
I haven't had been exposed to it.
No, one of our listeners reached out and asked me about it. And I don't know much about it.
I've just never had a chance.
Hold on. I'm going to nerd out a little bit. Peru is
us nerd out.
their food is so good. And it's fascinating because like they like double up on starches and stuff. Their staples are like things like taku taku, papas a la huacaina, the lomo saltado. The papas a la huacaina is like a boiled potato with like this sauce that's made out of a yellow chili that's really hard to find. You usually find it frozen, but it's called aji amarillo. It's like,
yeah, I've tasted those.
The listener, Alex, who used to work with us at the Woodlands, he just bought some seeds and he's going to try to grow some. He's going to keep us updated.
They have that floral habanero aroma,
yeah, dude.
But they don't
look
quite
like a yellow Anaheim. They're like really long, thick flesh. Yeah, they have some heat to them.
I've found them. I found them frozen and I found them dried, but I've never seen one fresh.
But they have like other, like they're a melting pot of cultures and techniques. Like they use a lot. There's a lot of Chinese influence. Like they use woks and do stir fries and stuff. Like lomo saltado is like a beef stir fry that's on like, you know, over with French fries and rice. That the sauce for that potato I was just talking about, like it's made out of the chilies, like crushed up crackers, cheese. If you would say that America is known for one thing, you know, most people in other countries probably say a burger. I don't know. Is the pollo a la brasa. Like it's basically charcoal chicken. There's like many different ways. I mean, I guess you might even, or you could say cuy, like they eat guinea pig down there, which I really want to try someday.
Me too. My wife would murder me.
Oh my God, I know. People would kill. It'd be like eating a horse or something. But
I ate horse in Montreal. Horse is pretty good.
I've had horse too, man. It is really, really tasty.
The dish was at Joe Beef. It was horse tartare with thinly shaved raw artichokes and thinly shaved parmesan and an egg yolk.
I heard like cooking in horse fat is really good. Somewhere in France or something, like they fry fries in horse fat. Apparently it's pretty interesting. I don't know, but like charcoal chicken, pollo alla brasa, it's like there's many different versions, but it's usually like marinated, like dry rubbed with like cumin and other spices, and then brushed with hoisin, and then like cooked on a rotisserie spit over charcoal. And then like you get like yucca fries, and it's usually three different sauces. It's like this green sauce that's made with, oh man, give me a second to remember the name of this herb because we grew it at the farm. Wakate. It's in the marigold family. It looks like, I don't know if you ever use like marigold, like gem marigold flowers.
For,
like,
I love those.
Yeah. But so imagine, you know, those leaves, it almost looks fern-like.
Leaves are incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Imagine like a more floral, more substantial, like you can almost like cook it like spinach, but they would like, you know, use it like paste, to like, you know, grind it to paste and stuff. But the green sauces, wakate, this herb, like jalapenos, lime juice, mayonnaise, some other things. The yellow sauce is that aji amarillo pepper with like mayonnaise and like fresh cheese and stuff. And then, you know, like, and then straight up mayonnaise. I could sit there and go find a Peruvian chicken joint. There's gotta be one down there. Like there's like 50 up there.
I don't think so, dude.
I've got Google right in front of me, so I'll give this a look.
Dude, find one. It's, even if you have to drive 30, 40, there's an onion and tomato salad called salsa criolla. I'm probably wrong. It's something like that, but it's just like onion, raw tomatoes, vinegar and cilantro, black pepper, the chicken, yucca fries, onion salsa, those three sauces. You'll pass out with chicken grease all over your face with a smile that lasts like a week.
I love that about you. Like all those menus that you did, like with all those themed ones, and then the ones we did together at Woodlands, like that, I always thought that was the coolest thing, and we learned so much. It wasn't just for the guests, it was for us too.
Yeah, we grew like so much cooking together, man. Such a good time.
Nate, let me jump in here for a second. I'm looking at it right now. Mario's Peruvian Chicken. It's in Mount Pleasant.
Go.
They got quarter chickens, half chickens, whole chickens.
Hang up the phone and go.
All right, we're going.
They have Mastrito, which is, what does that say? It's a like a fries, coleslaw, and quarter chicken dish. Lomo saltado. Arroz chaufa. They have ceviche. This is the real thing. Nate, when are we going to go to lunch at this place?
As soon as possible.
Today.
I'm not going to do that, and you know that.
I know.
Nate, I'm off Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday. Let's make this happen.
Okay, let's make it happen. We got to go.
All right, Tarver. You've inspired us. You're going to come
down. Tarver has spoken.
Yeah,
dude, when you get it, I'll get it. I'll get some Peruvian too. We'll all have it at the same time. And then
if Tarver tells me to eat something, I eat it. That is.
Hopefully they do it right there. It's really hard to mess it up, but man, it looks so pretty rustic. Good.
I mean, it looks like the menu that I was looking at looks like they've made some concessions for the fact that they're in South Carolina. Like there were a lot of just chicken and French fries type things on the menu, but it looks like if you want to go there and poke around, we can. I've actually been having a really great time with them. Cuban Gypsy Pantry is this new place. Nate, have you checked that out yet?
No, I haven't.
They have good Cuban sandwiches, and they have this thing called green fries, which is just French fries covered in like herb pesto and mayonnaise and huge handfuls of herbs. They're kind of gross, but they're also kind of amazing. At this place, they have ropa vieja, so the shredded braised beef, but they've also got beef picadillo, which is like a ground beef dish where it's like ground beef stewed with peppers, onions, raisins, cilantro, and like olives.
So good.
That's really incredible. And then they have this one other thing, mastitas de puerco. So all the entrees come with a piece of grilled plantain, a pile of black beans, and some yellow rice. So either you get the ropa vieja, or you get the picadillo, which is the ground beef with the olives over that, with the olives and the raisins, which is such a cool combination. That's sweet and salty. But then the mastitas de puerco, it's like pork belly tips. There's like big pieces of pork that are about half fat. And then I think they just deep fry them and toss them in some salt. So it's like this crunchy, chewy, soft at the same time pork tips with a big pile of rice and black beans. And like that's
it's like the Cuban version of burnt ends on beef barbecue, man.
Yes, exactly.
Awesome.
Exactly like that. And it's $13. And it's enough food.
That sounds good.
Like, so
do you think Uber Eats or Grubhub would go that far? Go all the way down to South Carolina for me?
I get Cuban Gypsy Pantry from Uber Eats all the time. I don't necessarily know that they would do that for you. I think they would, if you paid them $5,000, they might, but I feel like it'd be easier and cheaper just to make it yourself.
Yeah.
Cheaper. Not easier, but definitely cheaper. But yeah, there's like, I like discovering traditional dishes is where it's at. Are you guys familiar with Hmong people? H-M-O-N-G?
Is that the name of...
A little bit.
It's an ethnic group. Do you guys see the movie Gran Torino?
Yeah, that's how I know about him. That's the only thing I know about him.
The Gran Torino is about a racist old veteran grandpa.
Oh, I got to see that. I heard that's Clint Eastwood, right?
Yeah, played by Clint Eastwood. Yep. And he's super racist. He's a Korean War veteran. He does not like Asian people. And it's a pretty familiar story. It's the old guy that's racist sort of learns from the new culture and learns to set all that aside and be a good person again. That's not giving anything away. It's got a lot of ups and downs, but the people that were in there, the population that he was among was the Hmong people. They're from Southeast Asia, and they were sort of a people without a country because they backed the US and the West in the Vietnam War. And that did not play out in their favor. So the US did them a solid and was like, okay, you backed us in this little military action that did not work out. So we're going to give you asylum. And so there's big Hmong populations in Detroit, which is where Gran Torino took place, and also in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where my brother lives. So I was visiting him. We were there, and he's like, hey, man, why don't you go check some of this out? I don't think you can get this anywhere in South Carolina. So I did. I went to this flea market that had a food court, and it was bananas. Like, so good and so cheap. And it's funny because, like, when you walk through that place, the older generation were none of them spoke English. Or if they did, they spoke it with pretty thick accents. But then anybody that was, like, 35 or younger just talked like they were from Minnesota. Like, I had a Cubs shirt on, and I went up to this barbecue stall, and I was, like, you know, tentative because I'd had a couple of experiences. The last two people I talked to didn't speak that much English. They weren't used to Americans going there. And then the kid that was running the barbecue stall, he was of Hmong descent, but he was about 18, and he was just like, oh man, I like your shirt, Cubbies are totally my National League team. And I was like, okay, you're a big Twins fan? He's like, yeah, I'm a big Twins fan, but if I'm gonna pull for somebody in the NL, it's gonna be the Cubs. What can I get you? So it was this cool, like, seeing the second generation, or seeing the first generation of the ones that were born in America, be like still steeped in that culture, but at the same time not handicapped in terms of communicating, you know, and assimilating, being able to, you know, find work. It was pretty encouraging. It was interesting to watch the two cultures collide. But man, their food, they have made no concessions. It is very apparently authentic. They had all sorts of Asian style, like Vietnamese style noodle dishes, like that sort of Southeast Asian brothy noodles. But they also had this barbecue. It was like huge chunks of pork belly and huge, awesome sausages and like duck wings and just all sorts of just big pieces. Their style of barbecue is slow cook and then deep fry. So, not the sausages, but everything else. It was like, I don't know. I think they might've been simmered and then deep fried. So everything was crispy, but tender on the inside.
Sold.
And they served these huge pieces of meat over this purple sticky rice that they made with taro. So it was like steamed rice mixed with taro, so it really held its shape. And so that was kind of the starch. And then they served this chunky habanero salsa with it that you could definitely remove house paint with. And the stuff was absolutely brutal. Like, I was sitting down and I looked and there was this little 1 ounce cup of sauce. And I was like, man, that's not going to be enough sauce. And then I dipped the end of my piece of like brisket or whatever in there. And I took a bite. And I was like, oh my God, that's going to be plenty of sauce. It was like a fuel added. But the best thing I had there was this raw beef salad. So it was like raw diced beef along with thin shavings of braised pig skin. Like, they cooked a pig skin and then like rolled it up and let it chill like that and then put on a deli slicer. So they got thin ribbons of pig skin all throughout the beef along with mint, cilantro, scallions, hot pepper, fish sauce, and ground up toasted rice to give a little bit of texture. And then that, they just serve you like for $8, they'd give you a pint of that sitting on top of two lettuce leaves and a styrofoam clamshell. And it was just one of the best things I've ever eaten.
Sounds really good, man.
That sounds freaking awesome.
I love seeking out little pockets of cultures in the country and being able to find new things. It's just great. And if you ever go to St. Paul, Minnesota, which is like the Twin City, the other one that's not Minneapolis, the amount of crazy cool ethnic food that you find there, it's different than other cities. Like, Chicago didn't have this kind of stuff. They had multiple great Ethiopian places. So, like, you get, like, a big steamed injera bread and then all sorts of different cool little curries to put on it. I just had such a great time up in Minnesota. Like, I was up there, you know, doing family stuff, and I would just break away and be like, I'm just going to go get lunch somewhere. And just, it was such a great opportunity. I had so much fun.
That's awesome, man. That sounds really good.
I had so much, and my brother's a vegan, so sometimes I had to get away from him because I was like, well, you're going to sit around with your kids and eat beans and rice, so I'm going to go to the Hmong flea market and eat raw beef and a gigantic sausage. This is going to be awesome.
Sounds good, man. Sounds really good.
Yeah, dude.
We were talking about the blending of the cultures and like how the older generation was really just communicating among themselves in their own language, but their kids were obviously just Minnesotans who were, they were definitely holding on to their home culture, at least as far as the way they worked and the way they ate, but were also speaking unaccented English and, you know, chatting with the one white guy in the building about baseball, which is cool. I do love baseball, but it got me thinking a little bit.
What?
I know, right? it got me thinking a little bit about the notion of fusion cuisine. And I wanted to just sort of spitball with you guys about that because, like, I think the most interesting cuisines in the world come from border cuisines. Like, you know, the border between France and Germany, you get Alsatian, which is, like, as utilitarian as German cuisine, but at the same time as rich and over the top as cold weather French cuisine can be. Or, like, if you look at Montreal, you've got, like,
border cuisines. I've never heard that term before, and that is really interesting.
Well, then
border cuisine. Yeah, because it does kind of, I mean, Tex-Mex, that's a,
nachos are amazing. But then you also get cool things. You get artificial border cuisines sometimes when, for instance, a population is you know, displaced from their natural home, like the Hmong, and get dropped down in the Midwest to where, now I actually wasn't seeing that much assimilation yet. I mean, this only happened in like the mid 70s. So it's going to take a few decades for this to really get rolling.
Exactly.
But the fact that the kids had totally assimilated, or I don't know about totally, but at least the younger people that I was talking to were speaking English amongst themselves. I look at the next generation as they grow up and some of them open neighborhood restaurants, you might see some of this start to cross over. Like French Vietnamese is an artificial border cuisine. Like colonial cuisines. I don't know. I'm not a fan of colonialism. I think colonialism is categorically evil. But on the other hand, if you look at how France and Spain have both held Morocco over time, and then Moroccan cuisine has all this incredible Spanish influence, actually check that. It's Spanish cuisine that has Moroccan influence because of the Moorish invasion across the Strait of Gibraltar. So that's a result, like all in Southern Spanish cuisine, you get all this rice and raisins and olives and capers and stuff like that. Sicily too. The coolest cuisines come from the places where there's these borders. And I just want to compare and contrast that to fusion cuisine. Cause I mean,
there's the ones that are artificial, like you said, and then the ones that come through colonialism or wars or displacement and things like that. And they do happen eventually, but it takes a lot more time to settle in. It's still forced, but you know what I mean? It's not.
Well, it's, I think,
It eases in more naturally, I guess.
Yeah, when a population is displaced or if a population is colonized, I mean, you can see how the cuisines come together and it takes time. What I'm talking about when I say fusion are the trend in the 80s where the chefs just decided to like, hey, be like, oh, you know, I'll do French food with Thai accents. And like, I got nothing against Jean-Georges. I know that was kind of his thing in the beginning, but he unfortunately launched 10,000 mediocre restaurants. Not that he
watch
did.
Your tone, sir.
Not that he
well,
did.
Well, a lot of his came from Vietnamese influence, though.
What I'm saying is Jean-Georges' Southeast Asian meets French cuisine was extremely awesome. Good for 3 Michelin stars, but he had a lot of imitators. That's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Is that,
yes.
That sure, that's yes. My point. It was the wildfire.
His came from natural, like, more somewhat artificial fusion, like the French and Vietnamese.
Yeah, and then he traveled to Thailand and he brought Thai influence with him. You know, he opened up Vong and but the thing is, I'm not saying it was wrong when he did it. What I'm saying is when he got all those imitators, like he was the innovator. He had the chops to hold it down. but a whole bunch of other people just started incorporating curry paste into their French food. And those people were almost always American. And the 90s was just like fusion everything, you know, 90s and early 2000s, just fusion sweeping across the country.
Oversaturated with fusion.
And like, for instance, there's a restaurant that will remain nameless. It's in Charleston. And their cookbook, it's called something like Traditional Southern Recipes, after the name of the restaurant, which I'm not going to drop. And then the image for the cover of these traditional Southern recipes or traditional food from the South was a collard green spring roll. Now, that is hilarious.
Yeah, it is kind of, I'm like, what?
Shiitake mushroom spring roll.
And then, like, when you're seeing the proliferation of spring rolls at restaurants that don't have any other Asian content, the way Wolfgang Puck's has a sushi bar, despite the fact that, you know, there's just no other Japanese influence on the cuisine at all. It just has a sushi bar sort of tacked on. That's the kind of fusion that I feel like, when it's natural, when it comes from a population that grew together with another population over time, you get real tradition and intellect behind the dishes. But when a chef just decides, hey, I'm going to take these flavors and throw them into this kind of cuisine, I think it can get kind of hollow. You know what I mean?
It can work. Of course it can work. And, you know, well, there's the palate. But, you know, it's nice to have some backbone and some context for sure.
Like, I guess.
Well, I mean, I think there's also a little bit of a line here, too. There's traditional Asian dishes and there's traditional Asian, you know, flavors and that kind of thing. But there are techniques in that style of cooking, you know, that are very mineralistic, if that's the right word to use. I mean, that's kind of what we, you know, like when you season a bolognese, for example, with fish sauce, like a few drops of fish sauce, you're not enough to where you taste it, but it accentuates the meaty flavor like crazy.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, like using, you know, more Asian ingredients and, you know, like doing a collard green spring roll, that's like combining two things that's just like, I would try it. I'm not going to knock it before I try it. But like, just, you know, hearing that, I'm like, yeah, you know, but I guess what I'm trying to say is like using techniques and ingredients from other countries, anything wrong with
that? No, not at all. Not at all. I would say that, especially if you're using really fundamental, I mean, we use yuzu kosho, we use furikake, like using full Asian ingredients isn't really what I'm talking about.
You're talking more about conceptual restaurant concept, menu concept, full blown fusion, right? Like,
yeah, well, I mean, you can hide a lot behind
jamming
those Asian,
them together.
You can hide a lot behind those Asian flavors. Like, if you have a dish on your menu and the sauce is just not the chili, the sweet chili sauce, goosed up with some sriracha and a swirl of you know, soy sauce in there, that's not creative to me. That's just mixing stuff together. If you're using ingredients that are elemental, you know, like we talked about kombu, or if you look at like what's happening in San Fran with like Japanese ingredients are having a moment right now, and I'm not knocking them one bit, sneaking miso or soy into something, or even going even further down the rabbit hole. Like if you look at what Cezanne is doing in San Fran, there's so much Japanese ingredient. I want to clarify that is not what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Like on the one hand, you've got chefs that are opening their minds to cuisines and techniques from everywhere. And I feel like that's us, especially you two. I'm more of a traditionalist. I'm just not that creative a guy. But then you have the places that are from naturally occurring fusion cuisines where the stuff actually has time to build up over years. But then you've got the third category, and it was kind of a fad for the 90s and early 2000s, where rather than using global influence in a subtle way, it was just like serving a dish. I saw a dish one time and it was like a lobster salad with lemongrass and ginger. And they did a little ring mold of that, topped with that Carolyn Collins ginger Tobiko caviar. And then they topped it off with a tempura fried lobster claw served with quote unquote red curry aioli. And the red curry aioli was just mayonnaise, lime juice, and red curry paste. Like,
yeah, just go away. Like sesame crusted tuna and wasabi mashed potatoes. Like
wasabi mashed potatoes is exactly
just go
the
away.
Perfect explanation of what I'm trying to say. Like I think I'm coming off like a snob, but I'm not trying to. What I'm saying is when you blend together you know, cuisines of different continents, I either want there to be a backbone of tradition there or enough culinary intellect to be tasteful and express it properly. Like if an ingredient that's Asian is standing out and waving a flag and saying, look at me, it's probably not doing its job. If it's hanging out in the background of the flavor cord and making you be like, this is unbelievable and I can't figure out why, that's, I think, where the real meat of the approach. Trevor, am I on the...
Oh, yeah. I got you.
You know, there is a third category, though. Well, fourth category, because you've got, you know, hacky fusion cuisine, and you've got natural fusions, and then you've got globalism, which is using the ingredients not so much as the traditions. But then you've got a category four, which is just stuff that's so nuts and fun that it's almost worth it.
Yeah, I hear you.
The specific dish that, I mean, you know, it's stuff like, you know, I don't know, making nachos with chicken fingers instead of chips and stuff like that. Like, just getting crazy. But there's at the Peninsula Hotel Chicago, they had a dish. It was a croque monsieur, but it was a Chinese hotel, so it was a Peking duck croque monsieur. So they would take Peking ducks, like crispy red cooked ducks, and they got them from a specialty shop at Argyle Street, Chicago, Chinatown. And they'd dice them up and they'd mix them with white cheddar and scallions and then grill them on brioche that had been smeared with hoisin. And that was cuisine. And that was hacky cuisine. But it was also one of the absolute best sandwiches I've ever had in my life.
I was just about to say, like, if you're going to knock that, like, I can understand knocking it by calling it a croque monsieur because it's not.
Right.
But that sounds freaking awesome. You notice how I said freaking there?
Yeah, nice save.
You're welcome, Mom and Dad.
That's the thing is that, like, that's why I'm saying, you know, I may be coming off a little judgmental here because that dish on paper is like you just took two things and mixed them together, didn't you? It was one of the absolute best sandwiches I've ever had. So I suppose at the end of the day, there really is room for that stuff as long as it's executed extremely well. And that one was just such a funny concept. I mean, the Peninsula is a Chinese-owned hotel in the middle of Chicago. So it makes sense to me that they would – there's a certain logic to them having something that's kind of weird and fusion-y because the entire concept of the place was weird and fusion-y.
Well, that now I want that. I have such an addiction to duck. I need to have duck in my diet at least once a month, or I start to go through withdrawal.
Can we just say that duck is amazing?
Duck is
like,
amazing.
That is like one of my favorite animals,
dude. It is so,
and they're so beautiful.
Yeah.
And, oh my god.
Have you tried many like different breeds and stuff? I mean, we went through a few of them. We kind of settled on white Pekin as being
just the heavy hitters.
Yeah,
I've had white pekin and I've had Moulard,
Muscovy.
That's good. Yeah,
and then I've had real magre, which is super nice. Magres are Moulards, right? They're just Moulards that have yielded a foie gras.
I think so. Those foie gras ducks are good.
Yeah, that's what I understand.
Yeah, especially their legs, like long.
The steak. Legs, the breasts are kind of chewy, but
yeah. You ever work with geese or with geese at all?
I've still never had goose, not once.
We had a bunch of geese on the farm, really for weeds, because they would kind of walk around, just eat the weeds through the paths and stuff. Mm-hmm. But they would also eat asparagus, so that was kind of a problem. Anyway, long story short, they got too old, and they were geese get mean, man. They are mean mothers. Yeah, they're just like attack you. Anyway, long story short, we had to dispatch them, so we were using them in the restaurant. They were also a little older, you know, they weren't, you know, but the breasts were like, I mean, like to eat them, like if you were just like roast a goose breast, like it was beyond tough. Like I think we just ended up making hams out of them, but the legs and the carcass, the broth from the carcass was absolutely spectacular. But the legs, man, my God, they ended up being so good. We did this grilled goose salad. It was kind of like, you know, doing the same thing like Jess, you were just talking about, where it was like a long, slow cook. I can't remember if we did it like old school in an oven or if we sous vide or not, but like, and then like fry it in a wok, like really hot. So you're like really crunchy, and then like chopping the meat up. And then I can't remember what everything, it was like, it was goose meat, cardoons, pecorino, vershoe, and some other, I can't remember everything. Good Lord, it was so good. Like, I mean, like duck and squab. I feel like there's not enough squab on restaurants' menus.
No,
never enough squab.
That's my favorite protein.
Dude, squab's so good. I mean, and geese, I think, get a bad rap just because they can be a little bit difficult to work with. I remember when when I was at the Inn of Little Washington. So this was 2000, 2001, between 2000, 2001, 2002, somewhere in there. We did Goose for Christmas, and Lawrence Gottlieb, who was the exec stew at the time, got some geese in, and we just roasted them whole, you know, like the Christmas goose. And we ended up having to like switch mid like as service was starting, like, and not doing breast and only going like, you know, dark meat with it, because like it was just so unbelievably tough. Yeah. But there's just a process to it. I just don't think that people have practiced enough with it or used it enough to really delve into how tasty they can be. I mean, that's kind of where, like, you know, you get to start on that subject alone. You kind of get into foraging subject, because there are ingredients out there that no one ever really uses, and partly because like they're difficult to work with, they're either difficult to grow or raise, or just they're not as easy as like raising a chicken or growing a tomato. Like, that's like super easy, but if you want to like grow cardoons and you know forage for pawpaws and, you know, Indian pipe, you know, ingredients that no one really... Pawpaws, do you guys get pawpaws that far?
I wanted to ask you about pawpaws. I have never cooked with them. I've never used them. And I know you are pretty well-versed. Like, what can you do with them? Oh, how do you know when they're ready?
So many things. So, like, they ripen off the tree, but like almost like an avocado does. They're also known as a custard apple. And that is they should just be called custard apples instead of pawpaws, because that's exactly... I mean, they're like... They're the creme brulee growing on a tree. I mean, like, they're like the creamiest, sweetest. I mean, there's four main varieties, and I'm not going to be able to name them all. One of them's Davis. Anyways, one variety has more vanilla forward flavor. One of them is very much banana flavor. One of them has more floral, like mango. Anyway, like, they are so tasty. Have you ever had like Jamaican banana ketchup?
Yeah.
No.
Dude, banana ketchup made out of pawpaws. Freaking awesome. You're welcome,
Mom and Dad. Nice save.
Freaky. I have to send you this recipe it's like foolproof pie shell for pies. Like, it's a curd. It's basically a curd. Ooh. You should put it on the blog. We do it with so many different things. But this pawpaw pie that we've done is unbelievably good. But
because they're everywhere right here down here, and I want to go get some, but I don't know what to do with them, and everyone's asking me. I'm like,
yeah,
honestly, I've read about them, I know of them. I was like, but I know a guy.
Yeah. No, when you go in the forest and it smells like fermented, like it's like somebody's making booze in the forest, because like they're just all on the ground, like, you know, fermenting. Deer go nuts for them. Black bears go crazy for them. So you kind of have to get out there when the getting's good. But go get when they're big and fat. Up here, they come in season around October, so it's probably a little later for you. Probably more towards November.
Okay.
Just because you guys are in a warmer climate, I'm assuming. And anyway, when they're big and fat and they're starting to get brown on the outside, like bananas do, just go pick a bunch. And once they're soft, like an avocado is ripe, the best thing to do is the easiest way to clean them is just split them in half, because they have like a bunch of big black seeds down through the middle. You know, like resting racks in a kitchen, you know, like just get like a half hotel resting rack. And that's the fastest way to clean them. You just like split them in half and push the flesh through one of those racks. And that's the quickest, easiest way to get all the flesh apart.
Cool.
But cool. They go bad really quickly. So you want to use them before they go bad.
How do they freeze?
They freeze well if you cryovac. You'll have a hard. You won't need to freeze unless you have an overly abundant source, because like when you get them, you're going to use everything like immediately. They're so good. It's so good.
Yeah,
my buddy Ed in Columbia, South Carolina, in the upstate a little bit, said they're all over the trails right now. I got to get some.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if they're starting to show up now, then like they're not ready until the fall. So like,
okay. Fall.
Yeah.
So all right. Patient,
yeah.
The pastry
so
chef,
good, man.
The pastry chef of Trio before Curtis Duffy, her name was Paula Haney. She used them a lot, and she called them Indiana Bananas. That's their Midwestern nickname.
Interesting, yeah.
And I've tasted them. I didn't get to work with them. That was back when I was in my, you know, picking spinach and doing grunt work stage of my career. I was like 21. But she loved putting them in stuff. She did pawpaw curd tarts all the time. And she tried really hard to use some traditional sort of, they grow really well in the Midwest. It's just like they like it a little bit cooler. And she was always trying to, or at least this variety liked it a little bit cooler. So she was always making a conscious effort to use at least one cool foraged local fruit in her menus, which I always really respected. But yeah, she was super into them. So I'd love to check them out. So Nate, if you get a hold of some, do Tarver's curd, make a pie, and then like send me the recipe. I'll see if I can find some. I'll keep my eyes open. And
this curd I'm gonna send you, like it is an ace in the sleeve. You'll thank me for it. Like it's basically just like a curd with a massive amount of butter in it, and like you can do like any type of fruit. Like,
oh, that's what I was gonna say. So it's versatile.
It's extremely versatile. You can use it for savory things. Even like you can do like not even for pies and tarts. Like you can make the curd and like set it in a container in the fridge. And once it gets cold, you can take it out and whip it. When it's nice and cold, it'll whip up and it's like this beautiful silky texture, almost like Namlica or.
Man, I love curds.
Dude, all right. Yeah.
All right, Nate, here we go. Curd challenge. Tarver's going to send us this, this recipe. We'll put it on the blog, and then you and I will each make something with it, and see how that goes. You down?
Yeah,
I'm down. Great.
By the way, guys, we are getting way low on time.
Get going.
We're starting to run long. Plus, I got to be at work less than an hour. We're starting to get way low on time. So this has been a great conversation, we still have so much to discuss the next time we're on. I don't think we're ever going to run out of topics. Never. So I think we'll leave it at the curd challenge. Thank you all so much for listening. Speakeasy's going to play us out of here. I would like to especially thank Tarver Super King King, who has turned over a new leaf and doesn't curse constantly anymore. I would like to thank Nate Spinkick Whiting for providing his insight, banter, and of course savage spin kicks. This is for Sheree McDowell. I have been the mouth of the South, Jesse Sutton. We are closing this thing down. we're closing this thing down. Speakeasy's going to play us out, but join us next time. I have no idea what we're going to be talking about. We stopped planning because it's just way more fun this way. Look forward to seeing y'all in a week.
AKA Wieners and Fish Eggs.
Wieners and Fish Eggs. That's right. We have one of our listeners, the fantastic John Huff.
Love you, John.
Of Winder, Georgia, referred to sent us a copy of the trailer for the movie Pig and said that the Wiener and Fish Eggs guys are going to have to discuss that. So let's at least have that. We're going to talk about that next time for sure. Everything else, well, unless Tarver's on, then there's no way for me to say for sure what we're going to talk about.
I'm super excited about that movie, I got to say.
Okay, well,
it looks cool. I've never heard of it.
And I haven't
opened the trailer yet. That was at work when I got it, and I just kind of forgot about it until this moment. But yeah, so we'll be discussing the trailer for the movie Pig. But yeah, his exact words were, I think the Wieners and Fish Eggs guys should do a little talk on this. So, for Wieners and Fish Eggs, thank you all so much for listening. We'll see you next week on Wieners and Fish Eggs.
Bye-bye.
Hey.